This is Radio Fax, 6205 daytime, 1611 nighttime. If you'd like a copy of the specially printed QSL card and a six-page information sheet by return of post, please send 50 pence in British stamps or three international reply coupons to Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG.
All that you've got, and don't feel alone anymore. 'Cause when we're together, then you've got love. 'Cause I am the river, and you are the shore.
What's Dat on the Road? An article by M.A. Gifford from BBC Wales about the Sony Dat recorder. During April and May of this year, I was presented with the opportunity, courtesy of Clive Lawton, Sony Broadcast, to field test the model PCM2000 RDAT portable tape recorder. It was used for two projects. The first, a binaural documentary, which followed the Park and Dare National Fuel Distributors brass band to the European Championships held in Lucerne, Switzerland. And the second, a Radio 4 binaural drama, recorded on location in South Wales. The documentary was subsequently edited in the digital domain and transmitted in Wales from digital audio tape, making it the first of its kind for the BBC. The drama was also edited digitally, but transferred to Sony F1, the accepted digital transmission format for London continuities. Our trip to Lucerne began early one morning by heavily laden coach to Dover, where we tangled with the first of our customs clearances. Boarding the ferry went as planned, and the first real recordings of the project began. Opportunity was also taken to record some excellent sound effects of docking manoeuvres at Calais. Customs clearance at Calais was simplicity itself, but I learnt another important rule. Always carry BBC pens to give as freebies to French customs officers. Mile after mile of countryside followed, with an overnight stay outside Paris, before continuing across the country to Bâle. Our education continued, as we discovered that brass bandsmen, there are no women in this band, liked three things more than anything else: brass band music, beer, and loud brass band music. Partial deafness was quite common among the party. After unbelievable problems with the Swiss customs and several hours' delay, eventually we all came together and we promised to buy the party a drink as compensation. This was another mistake to learn from. A round of drinks for 28 in Switzerland came to £46. Travel continued, with constant use made of the portable digital audio tape recorder, both inside the bus and at watering holes en route. The microphones in use were Brühl & Kerr Type 4006 omnidirectional, mounted on a homemade binaural head. They gave impeccable performance throughout the period and have become a permanent part of my standard recording kit. The producer, Bob Coles, and myself discussed tactics, and he decided that whenever a member of the band spoke, the voice should take that position in the binaural image which it occupied in the band formation. For example, the trombone players would be far right and the cornet players far left. When, in the subsequent dubbing, music was added behind or around it and had the perspective of that player, so that the music behind the trombonist had the cornet as the central image. If you find that hard to follow, so did I at first. A further complication was that it was possible, due to the impeccable tuning and musicianship of the band, to crossfade between a rehearsal recorded in Triorchi and their performance in Lucerne, giving a very impressive effect. This type of mixing was made considerably easier by the use of a digital editor. Indeed, with conventional analogue tape and the multi-generation copying necessary, I doubt that the multiple imaging used would have stayed within a tolerable hiss level for the headphone wearers. The PCM200 proved to be a very useful tool for collecting material on location, and offered several useful features, although it was not without operational problems. The recorder measures 212 by 77 by 263 millimetres and weighs 4.2 kilograms including the battery. Input and output connections are on the right-hand side, while the left side carries connectors for the linear timecode facility. There is also a multi-way connector for future expansion. The front face is equipped with the main LCDs and level controls, while stop, start, fast forward and rewind and search buttons are located on the upper face along with the entry port for the cassette. After a few minutes familiarisation, the usual controls associated with a portable recorder of any type become apparent, and it is then very easy to collect, store and replay material to the highest technical standard. But this format is not just about recording. Careful reading of the Jap-English instruction manual is necessary to understand the remaining facilities. In addition, care must be taken over the selection of settings such as analog pre-emphasis and digital sampling rate. The main operational facility to explore is the invisible ident marking system, which allows the operator to put one of two kinds of starting point idents and a skip ident at any point on the tape, except within 9 seconds of a similar ident. After much operational experience, it would appear that it should be treated as two separate systems used in different circumstances. First, the program number system, which is similar to a compact disc track number and is applied during the record process. This, in conjunction with a written log, allowed accurate and speedy retrieval of selected takes of the outside broadcast drama for reference purposes on site and during the subsequent transfer to audio file for editing. Any marked point on the 2-hour tape can thus be accessed within 50 seconds at the quoted 200 times play speed. Program numbers increment automatically and are displayed in the LCD, both on record and playback. Unfortunately, if the battery fails or the machine is switched off, it defaults to zero. It is a pity that some form of backup battery could not be incorporated to save the inconvenience of incrementing the number manually, a facility which can be used at any time to select the next program number to be written. However, if replay is selected, to review the last item, for example, and then allow it to run on into previously recorded, identified material, the present program number will take that identity and increment from that number for future idents. Erasure of pre-recordings is by overwriting with new. Perhaps bulk erasure of pre-recorded cassettes should be recommended. A search function is incorporated, which will find the next program number in any direction and play the first 9 seconds of that item, before going into fast spool to locate the next, and so on until stopped. During playback, further ident marks can be applied, in the form of start or skip marks. These allow the user to select wanted portions of pre-recorded material and mark the beginning with a start ID and the end with a skip ID. During subsequent playback, the machine will play until it comes across a skip mark, when it will fast spool until it reaches the next start ID or program ID. This was the facility used in the documentary where 7 hours of material had to be condensed to 45 minutes of program time. Bob Coles was able to select and review his inserts away from the studio and theoretically just allow the RDAT to automatically transfer the inserts to the editing medium, in this case audio file. However, the accuracy of the markers was quite poor. For example, it was difficult to find the start of a word within a sentence, but worse still, having marked it accurately, its subsequent replay was very inaccurate, often missing words entirely. The practical trick here is to mark coarsely and take care of fine editing later. Used in this way, it is a very powerful aid to program compilation, with, of course, no destruction of the original inserts and greatly eased but unproven storage problems for the raw material. All idents are erasable. continuing with the article about digital audio tape recorders and the Sony portable R2000 machine by M.A. Gifford from BBC Wales. The accuracy of the clock timer was also much worse than we have come to expect of things digital, with wildly varying and inaccurate times displayed, due, I think, to tape slippage. It would be useful if the stop at zero memory function worked in fast forward as well as rewind. Indication is given of both elapsed time and time remaining on cassette, useful when making maximum use of the 2 hours recording time. Audio monitoring is by domestic headphone jack and excellent level indication from the LCD, which has an automatic shut-off backlight to conserve batteries. The line output connections, which carry input source at appropriate times, is available via 2 gold-plated domestic phono sockets and is of course unbalanced. Unfortunately, to monitor incoming signals, it is necessary to enter either record or pause record. This is unsatisfactory on 2 counts. The manual specifically warns against prolonged use of pause because of possible tape and or head wear, and it increases the battery drain considerably. Battery duration averaged 60 to 70 minutes overall, with best performance of 107 minutes when recording from line without pausing or stopping. Indication of a failing battery is by 2-stage warning. First a flashing bat in the LCD, then a CAUT, at which time no new function can be selected. Failure after that is pretty dramatic, as the tape, which is the most sensitive and least robust part of the RDAT system, cannot be removed, and on 2 occasions the tape was left only partially unlaced from the heads. I feel that more warning could be given, perhaps a bleep tone on the monitoring circuit, for example, as in practice, once a level has been taken and set, only infrequent glances are given to the main display. These problems could be overcome with the addition of a portable mixer, but this would compromise the superb portability and neatness of the package. Recording level control is by an ingeniously contrived pair of locking concentric knobs for the inputs of line, microphones or digital via the AES/EBU compatible port. Gain was satisfactory from the microphone XLRs, which are equipped with pads of 20 dB and 40 dB. Comprehensive phantom powering is also available. It is very easy to capture dynamic ranges approaching reality when used with good quality microphones, which can lead to problems when trying to broadcast the finished product. Gain on the analog line input seemed insufficient to me, it being necessary to turn the controls to maximum to achieve an indicated level of 24 dB below maximum with a BBC PPM4 level source. This gave a practical headroom of 16 dB, which is not needed in many circumstances and can result in quantizing noise being heard during quiet passages of normal program material. The general feel of the machine is very professional, and it is physically well balanced when clipped to the included carrying strap. After periods of 4 hours or more, no real discomfort was experienced. The freedom this allows made it possible to attempt what might have been impossible if encumbered with spools of tape, etc. For situations demanding less portability, the recorder will accommodate an external 12-volt DC supply, either mains or batteries, connected by means of the 4-pin XLR socket. Overall, this is a recorder which could radically change the method of operation of much sound recording work and makes an ideal medium for location recording and collection of sound effects. Provision has been made for the simultaneous recording of linear timecode from an external source onto a spare analog track. 2 problems are apparent with this system. 1 concerns the accuracy of code written on a tape travelling at only 0.3 inches per second and its subsequent reading without corruption. A timecode regenerator could be helpful here. The second is due to the delay imposed on the audio signal as it is recorded and replayed. This leads to an apparently constant and therefore correctable offset between signal and code. Unfortunately, no real use was made of this facility while in my possession due to lack of time, but obvious possibilities for high-quality sound collection in conjunction with video or film are apparent. It should be borne in mind, however, that first-generation editing would only be possible with a digital editor, of course. A second possibility I was unable to explore was that of compilation from one machine to another using the pause control on the recording machine. I understand from other sources that this should be very successful and makes small-scale compilation feasible at minimum cost. Editing on audio file proved a long process, with much time taken over loading and saving. Fine editing also proved laborious, although the flexibility always seemed to justify the extra time spent. Certainly the documentary was well received locally and has given us much to think about. Our next project involves the use of Dolby SR noise reduction. This will be used as an interim editing medium, with final editing and mixing executed on audio file.
Innovative information-based radio broadcasting to the people who really listen to shortwave. This is Radio Facts, 6205 daytime, 1611 nighttime.
And now a short item from the BBC Radio 4 radio programme with Laurie Taylor.
If there's one area of radio which could afford to live more dangerously, then surely it's student radio. So many university and college stations do little more than provide an opportunity for half a dozen students to play their favourite records and do second-rate impersonations of Gary Davis and Simon Bates. So, congratulations to the Guardian newspaper and the National Union of Students for incorporating a campus radio category within their National Student Media Awards. This year's winner was Ian Tong of the London College of Printing, with a tightly written, bravely researched, investigative feature on the Children of God, a sect which he alleges sends out attractive women missionaries, known as flirty fishers, to gain converts not by persuasion, but as one of its publications makes plain, by seduction.
Amongst chapters ranging from car maintenance to photography is one described as a manual for flirty fishers. It contains graphic instructions on how to join an escort agency and work as a prostitute, together with testimonies and advice from girls already involved.
I just thought I'd send in a few pointers I learned. Witness heavily the first night, as a lot of men say they'll be back, but too many times you never see them again. It really hooks them to tell them you're a Christian, as right away they know you're different. When making love, if anyone ever suggests anything abnormal, say no and tell them why. Turn it into a witness that the Bible is against this, and that without the love of Jesus in your heart, nothing can ever satisfy.
Children of God, produced and presented by Ian Tong.
And now to the English Midlands, and South Shropshire in particular.
Well, we've come up to Ludlow in Shropshire, and there was a thing called Sunshine Radio, which was operating 24 hours a day for something like 2 years, several years ago, and I'm with Graham Simmons.
The man that started it all.
Is that so?
Some say, yeah.
What made you go on the air 24 hours a day? Was it seeing Radio Jackie and London stations operating in that way?
Well, firstly, it wasn't 24 hours a day. It was about 12 hours a day, I think. But it was when I was working at one of the IBA stations called Wyvern. I was thoroughly sort of disillusioned with everything, so I thought, well, we can do it ourselves. So that's exactly what we did. Went and hustled a farmer to get some land together, you know. Aerials went up. Transmitters went in, station went on the air. All good stuff.
And at that time, the DTI appeared to be taking the attitude that responsibly run stations which weren't causing interference should be left alone. And you weren't raided for how many months?
6 weeks. 6 weeks it was, yeah. We actually started just weekends, Saturdays and Sundays. And I think it was the sixth Sunday we had the visit from the people, much to our disgust, you know. And then we had another raid. I hate that word raid, but we had another visit about 3 months after that. And then after that, it was peace, brother. There was no problems at all. I think we were a little bit responsible then, as always.
And you were on 7 days a week?
Well, by that time, yeah, 7 days a week.
And then you were left alone?
Well, we were left alone right the way through to the end of it, which we decided to call it a day after 2 years because of increasing pressure from, you know, the people and the demise of Radio Jackie. Mm. We thought the most responsible thing to do would be to close down and hopefully get that license to nail on the wall.
And locally, you had a very large proportion of the audience,
yeah.
Presumably?
Well, at that time, there was nothing else. There isn't much now, but, I mean, there was nothing else to relate to in this little niche, you know, around Ludlow and Tenbury. But I think it was probably missed for about 4 days, you know. Mm. Then people think there's something else to listen to, back to Radio 1, whatever it was. I think the people that didn't... The only people that I can think of that actually missed it was myself and about three other people. That was 4 years ago. We still miss it, you know. We're still trying to do things, to get things. And things do look quite encouraging now, don't they? You know, with various reports in various papers and whatever. So we just wait and see. But the organisation is still together. And we'll just wait and see what comes along from the new dereg.
And what kind of license would you like? What kind of operation would you ideally want to run?
Well, I don't think you've got the choice. I think what will happen is that you will be told what you can do. The license will cover you for a particular format, and that is it. I don't think you can sort of go bullheaded and say, we want to run a top 40 station, because, example, in this area, it wouldn't work anyway. So I think you have to be led by the professionals on what you can or cannot do. Once you take the attitude, we are going to do this, I mean, everybody would like to play continuous music, wouldn't they? I think every radio station would like to play continuous music and made loads and loads of money. 10 minutes of advertising, don't pay any DJs, have a carousel in the corner and just make a lot of money. I think that's what people would want to do, but they can't do that. It doesn't relate to anything anyway, does it? It may work in America, but here we are in the middle of Ludlow Town. Look around you, what do you see, Trevor? Fields. Mm. And a few people.
And so, you'd be on VHF or medium wave?
I think, again, it depends what is going to be offered, or what might be offered. If VHF is offered, I think there's a large proportion of people in this area that say, VH what? Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of their radios are just battered old echo sets with flat batteries and no aerials, you know? A lot of people don't know what VHF means. Again, in the inner cities, probably, well, I quite agree, VHF would be the thing to go to, you know? Beautiful 24 hours a day reception, no troubles. But out here, it will take a long time to educate people to listen to VHF. And if you're running a private enterprise station, which you've got to finance yourself from own resources, I think you'd be bankrupt before you educated the people into listening to VHF. Now, medium wave has always been a classic listening medium around here.
Yeah. When you were on, you had something like 50 advertisers a week, I think, from the
yeah.
local area, radius of 20 miles,
That's
something
right.
like that.
That's right.
Now, are any of these advertisers, since the ILR stations have come on the air and Sunshine's finished, have they used the ILR? Do they find that they get results from ILR advertising in the same way they did from Sunshine Radio advertising?
I think there's possibly about 20% of them that have tried local radio advertising, apart from Sunshine. And I suppose we can be blamed for sort of selling it too cheap, whereas we were selling airtime a week's advertising for about £50, £60 a week. A local ILR station would need about £400 or £500. So you put it into a relationship of Joe Bloggs down the road that's got a little business. He can budget £40, £50 a week, but he can't budget £500 a week. And those that have tried to flood the ILR market with loads of advertising have sort of said to me, after spending £4,000 or £5,000 with a radio station, the amount of input to their business in relationship to the amount of airtime that they've had just isn't worth it. So that's really all I can say. Again, if you're a national company with lots of money to write off against tax and whatever, it doesn't matter. But when you've got small business people trying to make a living with their own capital, they're very loath to lose it or waste it on something which they think probably doesn't do them a lot of good. Because, I mean, advertising is word of mouth anyway, isn't it? If somebody's got something to sell, somebody buys it. If it's any good, they tell their friends and their friends buy it. I mean, radio advertising is just a way of injecting the first word of mouth, I think. That's really what it's all about. Word of mouth advertising is the best. And really, that's all I can say on that subject.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything else you want to say?
I'd like to say hello, Mum, if she's listening, and anybody else that knows me. And could you play a record for my friend? And I've lost a budgerigar. And no, I would like to hear from... I mean, I would like to hear other people's reactions towards things. In the radio industry, there's a lot of talk. A lot of people blow things out of proportion. It's very easy to print things. People are pretty gullible. They believe things. It's all talked about, you know. I think the category which I've always looked at things is there's the doers, the talkers, and the thinkers. And I think I fall into the doers.
Mm-hmm. Do you think you're likely to be on the air in 1 year, 5 years, 10 years?
I've thought that for the last 6 years, that 1 year we shall be on the air legally, perhaps. I hate that word, legally. I like to sort of think that that we could be on the air running a service which is appreciated by people in this area. And within a timescale of, well, I think 2 years. I don't really want to be drawing my old age pension before we can get things started.
Tell us the technical stuff, yeah. The transmitter at Sunshine Radio in 1985, what power were you running, what was the system?
They'd tell me that it was about 500 watts, which is fed into an L aerial. I'm not very technical on this, but since then we've been told that the actual power which we were running was 500 to 600 watts into the aerial, and apparently about 5 was coming off of it, which was classic. So we wasted a lot of electricity in 2 years.
And what sort of coverage area did you have?
About 25 mile radius from Villa Farm, where it was actually being sort of broadcast from. 25 miles around Villa Farm, that was the the audience. They could listen to it properly from that farm. 25 miles, no more, no less.
During the day?
During the day, and during the night time, 4 miles. I would think the dark hours. The classic German interference on that particular channel at night time used to wipe it all out. You see, the point is what we're looking at. We want to cover 3 small towns, and each town has got, 12,000-14,000 people living in. And that is the area which we want to cover. South Shropshire, never mind Shropshire, but South Shropshire. That's what we would like to be able to cover. But we wait with bated breath to see what our friends at government level have to talk about.
Do they talk to you?
Oh yeah, yeah. They talk to us, and we talk back to them. But what is said really doesn't mean too much, you know. It is just talk. Back to my first comment: there's the doers, the thinkers, and the talkers. And I think I probably shouldn't say things like this, but unfortunately, I think we've got a lot of talkers in this country.
Graham Simmons there, talking about Sunshine Radio in Ludlow. And the frequency spoken about was 1017 kHz in the MF band, a frequency which has been allocated for use in that part of the country for something like 10 years now.
Everything's waiting for you.
This is Radio Fax, 6205 daytime, 1611 nighttime.
With Trevor Brook.
And Maggie Stevenson. On Tuesday, the 1st of November, the whole day's television was recorded for Prosperity. Mark Lawson from The Independent thought Prosperity might be puzzled. The dented steel box was forced from the torched earth in the early hours of 1st November AD 2188 by diggers of the Planet Earth Preliminary Exploration Team. Prized open, the box proved to contain recordings made on electronic memory cassettes, primitive in design, but recognisable to the scientists of the invading forces, of all the programmes broadcast on British television on Tuesday, 1st November 1988. A piece of paper sealed inside a plastic bag and attached to the inner lid of the steel box bore the words, "Organised by the British Film Institute, one day in the life of television," was an attempt to preserve for Prosperity the nature of British broadcasting at a time when it was under threat from government deregulation. Terrestrial historic archivists attached to the landing team at once began to view the cassettes and later produced a report on the nature of television on planet Earth 12 years before the end of the 20th millennium. It read, "Most of the actuality events on 1st November 1988 involved a political leader of England called, according to the various voices recorded during the day, as Thatcher, Fatcher, or Satzer. On the 9 o'clock news, BBC One, a man in spectacles with an accent matching no humanoid voice pattern on record was calling her Thatcher. Thatcher, Fatcher, Satzer, Thatcher seems to have been a famously cruel leader. On this day alone, she appeared to have put into action a scheme to remove the eyes and teeth of the poor. On the first programme of the morning, Breakfast Time BBC One and Good Morning Britain ITV, politicians of the time were heard condemning the harshness of this plan. Teeth and eyes are very important. I will be voting against the government on this one," said a Dame Jill Knight. Mrs. Thatcher was also active abroad, preparing, it appears, for an invasion of Poland. Reports from the country on every news programme stated that the Polish government was nervously waiting her arrival there. All the news programmes seemed to be rather frightened of the leader, or Prime Minister, and yet the obvious supposition that she personally controlled television cannot be correct, as several commentators reporting on the One a Day in Television project, of which these tapes are part, referred during the day to the independence of British television. It should be pointed out that this blinder of the poor and invader of Eastern Europe was not the head of state of the section of the planet called England. There was much coverage, particularly on the programme called Good Morning Britain, of something called the Royal Family. The exact amount of power possessed by this family is not clear, but from remarks on Daytime Live, BBC One, it appears that a son of the dynasty, Prince Charles, had the right to tour the country, pointing out buildings which he wished to be pulled down. Fearing his wrath, programmes complementary to modern architecture, like Building Sites on BBC Two, would be very short and screened late at night. A branch of the royal family, which was in exile in a place called Australia, and thus forcibly separated from their infant children, particularly a baby identified, perhaps for security reasons, only as Princess B. "How long has the Duchess of York been apart from Princess B now?" asked Anne Diamond, the presenter of Good Morning Britain, to one of those men who were employed as soothsayers to guess the future of the royal family. Two of the most prominent seers, called James Whittaker and Nigel Dempster, would appear on television in the early morning and divine the future direction of the family. "I think, Anne, that Fergie is simply determined not to have another broken marriage in her family. She's going to be a wife first and a mother second." As a public service, the BBC was broadcasting twice daily Neighbours on BBC One. This series screened incidents from ordinary family life in Australia. Although there was little excitement and the people featured had few acting skills, tens of millions would tune in, hoping to hear news of the exiled members of the royal family. The human being of 1988
seems to have been deeply unhappy, prey to a frightening variety of vices and diseases. Several programmes each day were filled with the victims of these punishments from their god. On Kilroy, BBC One, it was women who had been raped by their husbands. "By then, I was in a 2-4 part rape," said a woman. "Tell us exactly what you mean by that," said the presenter, Robert Kilroy Silk, who, it must be reported, did not seem like a normal human being. He was a deep brown colour, despite the evidence of the programmes called Weather, BBC One, that the sun rarely reached this corner of the planet, and pronounced the news as news. On the Time, the place, Granada, women who had not been raped by their husbands stood accused by the men in their lives of running up substantial debts on credit cards. On the Oprah Winfrey Show, second wives debated with first wives the difficulties of men. Desperately unhappy, the citizen of 1988 seems to have also been starving. Nearly all of the advertisements between programmes, the revenue from which paid for the programmes on the ITV network, depict serious shortages of food and the extraordinary lengths to which the hungry would go to feed themselves. In one commercial, an elderly woman finished a biscuit before fending off a murderer. In another, three people clashed their bowls together in conflict for a single slice of ice cream. Women would give themselves sexually to men in exchange for a cup of coffee. There was also a shortage of consumer durables, perhaps as a result of another policy of Mrs. Thatcher. If somebody wanted a new kettle or a holiday abroad, they appeared on a programme like Going for Gold, BBC One, and received the goods only if they were able to correctly answer questions on their country's history, like who were the Scandinavian warriors who invaded England. A surprising number of those wanting kettles or holidays could not answer. In the afternoons, they watched their past, which had no colour. Tank Force, Thames, appeared to take to be a commemoration of a victory in a battle over a tribe which dressed in grey and began every other word with the letter V. Vino vot you want. When they sought amusement, they preferred jokes which they already knew. It is calculated that each viewer had seen the episode of Forty Towers, BBC One, broadcast on 1st November 1988, 5 times before, and the episode of Rising Damp, Thames, 3 times. In short, there was little on display in the tapes to suggest a system which must at all costs be defended. And yet it must also be reported that diaries of viewers and critics, also stored in the box, spoke of a tradition of original drama, investigative reporting, and refusal to stoop to the lowest denominator. Little of this was reflected in the preserved tapes, and we are forced to conclude that perhaps they chose the wrong day, and that perhaps the real failure of the broadcasting community was an inability to present its strengths to Mrs. Thatcher. Final query, what was Kylie Minogue? Well, that's an article written on the storage of all television tapes on 1st of November by Mark Lawson of The Independent.
I'm in the phone booth. One across the hall.
Go to work or just go to the store. All those things she said I told.
everybody's changing their theme tunes. World Service Rings Changes by Peter Fiddick, media editor of The Guardian. Imperial Echoes, the march which for decades has introduced Radio Newsreel on the BBC World Service, or the Home Service before it, has resounded around the world for the last time. It has been replaced by a synthesizer orchestrated version to reflect, quote, the Britain of today. The change is part of a package announced by Mr. John Tusser, Managing Director of BBC External Services. The chimes of Big Ben and the station's main signature tune, Lily Bolero, remain, but a new nightly current affairs programme, NewsHour, will go out at 2200 GMT. Other new programmes include Newsreel, an updated version of Radio Newsreel, less reliant on correspondence reports, News Desk, to be run four times a day, Financial News, featured up to 10 times a day, World Brief, each Sunday, summarising the week's news, and How It All Began, tracing the origins of running stories. Megamix, aimed at young people, follows the recently launched pop science and will build audiences in the decade ahead, Mr. Tusser hopes. Audience research has revealed that Britain's 6 million expatriates do not, as previously thought, form a large proportion of the listeners. The 25 million strong audience, one-third in Asia, a quarter in Africa, a quarter in Europe, and most of the rest in the Americas, do not speak English as their first language, and are more likely to be under 30 years old, well-educated, and male. And satellites. Two more television channels have committed themselves to the Astra satellite, available to most British viewers next year if they have a small home dish antenna. WH Smith Television is to switch its lifestyle, aimed at women at home, and screen sport cable channels to Astra, joining the four Sky channels already announced.
12 seconds that herald the headlines. Mark Leitman from The Independent on the latest tune to introduce the BBC News. An orchestra of more than 50 musicians filed solemnly into the Abbey Road recording studios in North London. George Fenton climbed to the rostrum and, with a toss of his thick black hair, called them to order. 3 hours later, they emerged, having duly recorded his masterwork, a 12-second, 10-beat signature tune for the new BBC 9 o'clock news. "I suppose you feel they should be creating more than that when they're there for that length of time," said Mr. Fenton apologetically. "But Parkinson's Law made sure we filled the time available." The tune, now revealed to viewers, along with Martin Lambinane's title graphics, introducing the new Back to Basics bulletin. Mr. Fenton will not be remotely offended if you cannot yet whistle it to yourself. As one of the most experienced exponents of the minimalist techniques required in this sort of composition, he does not believe the news should be preceded by anything instantly memorable. "Because it's heard so often, it shouldn't be overly simplistic, or it will pall rather quickly," he says. "People shouldn't be humming along with the news, and it has to be equally suitable for a bulletin that begins with good news as for one that opens with a disaster." He speaks from a background of nearly 10 years composing signature tunes for BBC News and Current Affairs programmes. It began when George Carey, his brother-in-law, asked him to compose a resonant theme for the BBC Two programme Newsnight, which Mr. Carey was editing. Mr. Fenton primarily composes themes for television dramas, including Shoestring, Bergerac and Jewel in the Crown, and for some of the most successful British films of the decade, Gandhi, Cry Freedom and White Mischief are among his credits.
Putting electricity in store, from the Times Science Report. Electricity generation and distribution companies in the United States face an increasing demand for power and increasing political pressures to be less environmentally damaging. One company in Alabama believes that a new energy storage plant, which works by filling underground caverns with compressed air, will solve this dilemma. Electricity is the universal energy medium of modern society, chiefly because of the ease with which it can be delivered. Its great disadvantage is that once generated, it must be used. There is no simple way electrical power can be stored. To satisfy all its customers, a generating company must have enough capacity to meet the peak demands. The expectation that electric power should be ready at all times makes it very hard to design efficient power stations. It would be much easier to build power stations that ran at exactly the same rate 24 hours a day. The need to keep electricity prices low, coupled with concern for natural energy resources, has pushed engineers to think of ways to store energy generated when demand is low and put it back into the system as needed. All commercial electricity is generated by using energy to spin a dynamo, and energy storage systems add another stage in which electrical energy is converted into something which can be held in reserve and then used to run a standard generating device as needed. In one scheme, electricity pumps water uphill into a reservoir and is recovered by allowing the water to run downhill through turbines which generate electric power. But this system is efficient only on a huge scale, which makes it unpopular with environmentalists. The facility now being built by the Alabama Electric Cooperative is based on an equally simple principle. Excess electricity pumps air at high pressure into holes in the ground, and the compressed air is released to drive turbines when electricity is needed again. By use of standard off-the-shelf technology and natural geological features, the system can be run efficiently at quite small scales. The Alabama plant will generate 110 megawatts, enough for a few good-sized towns, but much smaller than the thousands of megawatts produced by standard coal-fired nuclear or hydroelectric power stations. The underground caverns are made by drilling into the salt deposit and dissolving it with water. The resulting cavities have hard, glass-like surfaces of dense crystalline salt, able to retain air at the enormous pressure of 1,000 pounds per square inch. A similar scheme has been operating successfully in West Germany for 10 years, but the Alabama device is more efficient in its conversion of electricity to compressed air and back again, and has only about a third the generating capacity of the German facility. This is an advantage, because it allows fairly small regional electricity companies to build and operate their own storage plants. That article by David Linley in The Times.
Also from The Times, a report by Richard Evans, their media editor, Italians control television channel. Super Channel, the British-based European satellite television channel, officially launched in January 1987 by Mrs. Margaret Thatcher, came under the control of an Italian media group. After weeks of negotiations aimed at saving the heavy loss-making concern, Video Music, the Italian rock music television station took a 55% shareholding and agreed to take on liabilities of around £8 million. Mr. Richard Branson's Virgin Group will retain its 45% share in the company. Super Channel, which was launched with the idea of providing the best of British to a pan-European audience, has accumulated losses of £60 million in the 21 months of its existence. Its programmes are distributed via cable into 13 million European homes, mostly outside Britain. Video Music, owned by Better Television, has bought shares from independent companies who have helped set up the satellite venture, including TVS, Yorkshire and Anglia, who are the remaining shareholders. Independent Television News, which supplies a service to Super Channel for £1.9 million a year, is likely to benefit from the change. It provides 4 15-minute bulletins a day and may be asked to provide more news at peak time as well as summaries.
And now Eddie Caffrey with a million-selling single.
The Easy Beats, Friday on My Mind, on the United Artists record label in Britain in the year 1966. Original catalogue number, UP1157. On the B-side, Made My Bed, Gonna Lie In It. The Easy Beats were designated as an Australian group, although all its members are sons of European parents who emigrated to Australia. The young immigrants met in a hostel in Sydney and played at various clubs in the vicinity. After a year or so, they made their first disc, For My Woman, which only had small success. However, their second disc, She's So Fine, got them the number one position in the Australian charts and established them. By July 1966, four of their six discs reached the top chart position, making them the most popular group down under, with riots whenever they appeared. And several awards followed that: Best Group, Most Original Group, and Best Vocal Group in Australia. The Easy Beats made their big impact on the pop music scene in April 1965, when they appeared at the Village, Sydney, receiving them lots of gain and recognition also in the USA. Friday On My Mind was the group's first English-produced disc by United Artists. It was issued on the Parlophone record label in Australia and stayed number one down under for 6 weeks. It reached number six in Britain in December of 1966, and it stayed 16 weeks in the charts. Sales in Britain were over 250,000, and a gold disc for global million sales was presented to them in May 1967 in Australia. They made a short tour of America and also toured Germany in 67, in addition to British appearances. The Easy Beats were George Young, born 6 November 1947, Glasgow, Scotland. Gordon Snowy Fleet, born 16 August 1945 in Bootle, Lancashire. Vic Diamond, born 28 December 1947 in Hilversum, Holland. Harry Vanda, born 22nd March 1947 in The Hague, Holland. And Little Steve Wright, born 20th December 1948 in Leeds, Yorkshire. Vanda and Young played guitar, Wright played drums and guitar, and Diamond played bass, and Fleet played drums, in addition to their singing as well. Friday On My Mind was written by Vanda and Young, who wrote most of the group's hits. The Easy Beats, Friday On My Mind.
Monday morning feels so bad. Everybody seems to nag me. Coming Tuesday, I feel better.
Report by The Guardian on the hacker who shook a secret service, a report by Owen Boycott. Edward Austin Seng, the 23-year-old British computer hacker who has penetrated defence networks on both sides of the Atlantic, has been debriefed by three American Secret Service investigators.
Security experts warned he may have exposed dangerous flaws in international defence computer systems. Scotland Yard's Serious Crime Squad continued its inquiries into the hacker, who dropped out of Teesside Polytechnic and now lives in Leatherhead, Surrey. He fears he could face an Official Secrets Act prosecution, but believes he has done nothing illegal. Working with hacking colleagues in America, Britain, West Germany and South Africa, mostly on one type of computer system, Singh gained access to 250 sensitive military, commercial and academic systems around the world. He breached the computer systems of the Admiralty Surface Weapons Research Establishment in Britain and NASA, the top security Milnet network, and TRW, the nuclear weapons manufacturers in the United States. Talking from a friend's house in Surrey, Mr. Singh said he tried to run a war simulation program out of curiosity when he broke into the US Nuclear Defense Agency computer. Security loopholes in Western commercial, academic, and military systems are known but ignored, he claimed. Charged with burglary, he has been dealt with by means of a caution, but the Serious Crime Squad called in American investigators after uncovering piles of printouts and documents indicating he had penetrated US defense and commercial networks. Mr. Singh believes hacking should be outlawed, but the real problem is with security administrators. There are no rules in this game. People don't understand that. I got into the US Army files. They were all insecure. We went into Ford computers in Britain, and there were car designs. I phoned the Open University once to warn them hackers were costing them so much money. Unemployed, he was arrested on October the 9th after he had approached an American computer manufacturer in this country and offered for a consultancy fee of £3,000 to explain weaknesses in their systems. I wanted to help them, he said. I was worried on behalf of the users. I felt uneasy in getting in so easily. On the public networks, 75% of systems are insecure. He scorns the police claim that he was trapped by clever detective work, since he had given his real name and said he was working on computers at Surrey University. I first started using a computer when I was 11 at school, he said. At East Surrey College, I did computing science A-level. I broke its computer's defences down and got into all the administration files. I was caught when I printed the password list out and someone saw it coming off the computer. The thrill is primarily intellectual. It's enjoyment. It's for the type of person who likes doing the puzzles in Scientific American magazine. I have never destroyed any data or been interested in the information. After college, he went to work in National Employers Life in Dorking in the mortgage department. At this time, he used his skill to obtain £600 from a bank by manipulating the electronic funds transfer system. I handed myself in to the police after I'd been away to Greece for a prolonged holiday, he said. I was convicted of computer fraud and fined. That was my one offence. He spent a year unemployed, developing hacking skills using a BBC microcomputer and a modem. During this time, he broke into CERN, the International Physics Research Station in Switzerland. The type of computers at Teesside Polytechnic attracted him, and he was accepted for a computer course. One of his lecturers, Dr. John Wilford, tried to persuade him to give up hacking. He spent a lot of time hacking rather than attending classes, Dr. Wilford said. He had a very pleasant manner and was quite, I'm sure he did, yes.
This is an incredible story, but it is a true one.
Oh, God. He had a very pleasant manner and was quite penitent about it. He would stop for a while when I spoke to him, but he was compulsive. He always went back to it. Sorry. A closed CBI conference called Combating Computer Crime, Increasing Computer Security has been given added urgency. Mr. Peter Summer, a security consultant with Data Integrity and author under the pseudonym Hugo Cornwell of the Hacker's Handbook, said he appears to have discovered a major flaw in the operating system of this family of computers. It's highly unexpected, but not impossible. There are large numbers of commercial and defence organisations using these computers. They may have to take their computers off the network lines. Well, that's about Edward Austin Singh, a young computer hacker, as reported in The Guardian recently.
Absolutely amazing. How hackers put computer society integrity at risk. A letter from the British Computer Society to The Guardian. Your article concerning unauthorised access to computer systems raises a subject of crucial importance. The British Computer Society has discussed and commented on both the technical and social consequences of this activity. It has pressed both the government and the EEC for action, and in June urged the Home Office to consider legislation which, in line with the report of the Scottish Law Commission, would make the act of unauthorised access an offence. The recent decision of the English Law Commission to consider its legal implications is perhaps an indication that this subject is now taken seriously. The use of computer systems is not limited to defence or financial activities, but covers also many other areas critical to the well-being of individuals and society. The importance of this point cannot be too strongly stressed. The insistence by hackers that their activities are not malicious, that they expose flaws in system security, or are merely intellectual exercises, is neither valid justification nor excuse. The consequences of unauthorised access do not depend on the attitude of the hacker, nor on the possibility for personal advantage in successfully appraising the contents of a file. Access to any system involves some degree of interaction with it, and the proper procedures for legitimate entry to and exit from the system are designed to maintain the integrity of that system during these phases. Failure to follow the appropriate entry procedures will normally result in denial of access. At this point, the question of authorisation is usually clear to the would-be entrant. Further attempts at unauthorised access are likely to be through a determined effort to change the access controls. The integrity of the whole system is put at risk from this activity, whether successful or not. Damage so caused may either change the behaviour of the system or lead to corruption of data within it. The result of this damage may not be seen immediately. Nevertheless, any computer system which is run in a condition different to that in which it was originally validated will at some time produce output which is different from that which the originally intact system would have produced. Whether the consequential action results in an incorrect transfer of funds between personal bank accounts, causes a life support system to fail, or affects the control system of a power station, the principle remains the same. The legality of any act which can result in such consequences cannot be justified. The effective and reliable processing of information is both a necessary element in the trust placed in computer systems by all those who are dependent on them, and the basis of a sound computer industry. The activities of hackers puts both in jeopardy. We cannot allow this problem to remain. Yours sincerely, J.R. Brooks, Chief Executive and Secretary General, the British Computer Society, 13 Mansfield Street, London, West 1.
After the turn of the century, in the clear blue skies over Germany, came a roar and a thunder men had never heard, like the screaming sound of a big war bird. Up in the sky, a man in a plane, Baron von Richthofen was his name. 80 men tried and 80 men died. Now they're buried together on the countryside. 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 or more, the bloody red baron was rolling up the score. 80 men died trying to end that spree of the bloody red baron of Germany. In the nick of time, a hero arose, a funny looking dog with a big black nose. He flew into the sky to seek revenge, but the baron shot him down.
Curses wild again.
10, 20, 30, 40, 50 or more, the bloody red Germany. Now Snoopy had swore that he'd get that man, so he asked the great pumpkin for a new battle plan. He challenged the German to a real dog fight. While the Baron was laughing, he got him in his sight. Fired once and it fired twice, and that bloody red bear went spinning out of sight. 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 or more, the bloody red bear was wrong on the score. 80 men died trying to end that spree of the bloody red bear of Germany.
Are you interested in improving AM reception? We are now producing a PhaseLock AM synchronous detector unit. There are four controls on the front panel. Loop, wide, medium or narrow, allows use with unstable signals or transmitters carrying phase modulated radio data. Next, a selector provides low distortion envelope detection, double sideband, lower sideband, upper sideband, independent sideband or stereo spread, giving intriguing effects with lower sideband on the left and upper sideband on the right, and quadrature, which nulls the modulation of the strongest station on the channel and allows audio from any weaker co-channel station to be heard more clearly. The remaining two controls are center frequency and window on-off, which enables the unit to hold lock tenaciously, even under severe interference or complete fade-out. Apart from the well-known benefit of reducing the gross distortion of selective fading, synchronous detection also provides an improvement in signal-to-noise ratio. The remaining objectionable effect during a selective fade is the surging in audio level, as the receiver AGC unnecessarily increases the gain. So our unit also includes a broadcast quality multiple time constant audio limiter. The complete boxed unit costs £150, and a detailed information sheet is available if you send along 1 14-pence British stamp or 1 international reply coupon to Radio Facts, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG.
Television isn't alone in benefiting from satellite engineering. Chris Daubney, IBA Assistant Director of Engineering, Policy and Projects, reported on the potential of satellite technology for radio services in a recent edition of Airwaves magazine, the quarterly journal of the IBA. We've become accustomed, while watching on television events taking place at some far distant venue, to seeing a caption such as "Live from somewhere." If we stop to think about it all, we take for granted that at least one satellite may well be involved in conveying the pictures of this distant event to our homes. Before very long in the United Kingdom, we shall again be reminded of pictures from space when the IBA's satellite broadcasting contractor, BSB, starts its operational direct broadcasting by satellite, DBS, television services in the autumn of 1989. However, what few people realise is that satellites, both current and future, offer opportunities in different ways for radio broadcasting. The advent of satellite broadcasting, including DBS, is a watershed in broadcasting. No existing television or radio set will receive satellite transmissions without some additional equipment. Because, therefore, everybody either has to buy the additional equipment or purchase a new set which incorporates it, the opportunity arises for the broadcasters, and particularly the public, to benefit from some changes to the way in which the broadcasting signals are transmitted. There are three main criteria for such changes. One, to remove as many as possible of the deficiencies of the present systems. 2. To make sure that with the increasing demand for broadcasting and information services within the limited channels available, the capacity for such satellite channels is optimally used. And 3. To offer the public the possibility of future improvements to the existing services and or of new services. Based on these axioms, the IBA engineers made a major contribution to broadcasting technology by developing the MAC satellite transmission system. It is now mandatory for all DBS transmissions within countries of the European Community to use one of the MAC, properly called the MAC packet family of standards. Strictly speaking, MAC describes the picture part of the standard, but the IBA's engineers also contributed significant work to the establishment of the sound and data parts. And it is in this latter part where, of course, the opportunities for radio by satellite partially lie. The sound and data part of the MAC standard conforms to our three criteria. Firstly, it uses digital technology, akin to the techniques used in compact disc, CD, players, to improve the quality. Secondly, it is possible for 8 very high-quality sound channels to be conveyed simultaneously with a MAC picture signal. Clearly, 1 or 2 of the 8 will be needed for the sound side of television service, but that could still leave the 6 sound channels for other uses. However, one of the key elements of the sound and data, e.g. teletext, part of the MAC standard, is its flexibility. Because the sound is conveyed in digital form, similar to that used for computer-type data, it's quite possible for the proportions of the available capacity allocated to sound and to data to be varied in a controlled way, depending upon requirements. In fact, since the transmission of data is of increasing interest, it is very likely that there will be competing pressures on the use of this sound and data part. So far as the other sound services are concerned, broadcasters in some parts of Europe are looking very closely at the possibility of stereophonic radio transmissions alongside or instead of television programmes from DBS satellites. Clearly, even if the television pictures were accompanied by stereophonic sound, it is possible to have 3 other stereophonic radio services, each providing national or even international coverage. While all these possibilities are being developed, however, the current satellite channels can also carry services for radio, and there has been some recent renewed interest in these opportunities. The present television transmissions via the less powerful telecommunication satellites, which are aimed primarily at cable distribution systems, use the existing colour television standards. But it is possible to add a small amount of extra information over and above the picture signal, including teletext, and its accompanying monophonic sound. This can be done by utilising subcarriers. It is always important to distinguish between the messenger and the message that it bears. In broadcasting technology, the programme signals are the messages. The messengers are the very high-frequency carriers onto which we superimpose the programme signals at the broadcasting end, and which are discarded in the television or radio receiver once the carrier with the desired programme on has been selected. Within a broadcasting channel, it's sometimes possible and or useful to add subcarriers. These can allow extra information to be conveyed and are generally added to the main programme signal, but in a way which does not cause interference either to it or to those signals being conveyed on the subcarriers before the whole signal is superimposed on the main carrier. A classic radio example of the use of subcarriers is the way in which, on the VHF services, the extra information for stereophony is added to the monophonic signal. A subcarrier is used to convey the second piece of information which is needed by stereo receivers. This can be ignored by mono radios, while in stereo versions it is possible to distinguish between the two signals and so recover them as 2 separate pieces of information. Thus, the current ILR interest in satellites centres around the possibilities of using subcarriers to piggyback stereophonic radio programmes onto satellite channels being used for some other, quite separate, television purpose. In this context, however, satellites are used as a means of conveying those radio programmes not directly to the listening public, but between radio company studios. Virgin Broadcasting's Radio Radio, overnight sustaining service, featuring programmes presented by Jonathan Ross, Johnny Walker and others, arrives at client ILR stations by satellite. Radio Nova, based in Camberley, Surrey, offers a 24-hour music radio service to dish owners and cable operators throughout Europe. Currently, two ILR stations carry Nova's programmes daily between midnight and 6 in the morning. A number of ILR stations have formed a company called Satellite Media Services, which will be offering mono, stereo and data transmission services to independent programme suppliers, advertisers and others early in 1989, thereby giving easy access to radio stations countrywide and beyond. Satellite radio distribution clearly has a useful part to play as a means of distributing programmes in high quality stereo from the place where they are happening to radio stations which might either be directly broadcasting them immediately or recording them for future transmission. And with the proposed growth in local and community radio, the provision of such satellite distribution services seems likely to increase. In the main, current distribution services use an analogue system, but digital distribution services will also be available before long. Digital signals have both advantages and disadvantages when compared with their analogue equivalents. One advantage is that the wanted programme signals are carried as a stream of very simple on-off information, essentially whether a switch in the converter which turns the programme signals into their digital form was on or off at any given moment. So long as the receiving end can tell reliably one state from the other at all times, the digital signals can be reconverted to produce high-quality programme signals. In general, it is possible to make such a distinction even when the amount of hiss or background noise would make the use of normal analogue techniques unacceptable, though there is, of course, a limit beyond which even digital signals cannot be recovered satisfactorily. Hiss is one of the main problem areas with satellite transmitters because of the very weak signals which are received on Earth, particularly from telecommunications satellites as opposed to DBS satellites. When the extra sound channels are carried as analogue signals, it is necessary to use a separate subcarrier for each signal, i.e. stereo needs two subcarriers. The hiss problem rules out the idea of using the terrestrial VHF radio stereo system on one subcarrier. In efficiency terms, the present satellite channels can accommodate the two subcarriers needed for one analogue stereo signal. The same channels will also be able to accommodate a digital system capable of handling simultaneously two high-quality stereo pairs, two medium-quality mono signals, and a small amount of data. As with the sound and data part of the Mac DBS standard, digital techniques will undoubtedly dominate in the end. They offer more opportunities for dissemination of remote control and other information signals, such as titles, contents, and copyright details, which can be fed directly into computer-operated logging and transmission systems at the receiving end. In addition, they provide CD-type program quality, and, judging by the rate at which CD equipment is being purchased, this is clearly a growing priority with the listening public. Well, that was a report by Chris Daubney, the IBA Assistant Director of Engineering, in a recent edition of Airwaves magazine.
From Communications Week, Italy has joined Britain, France and Germany in their plans to set up a UHF paging network that will operate between those countries as an interim solution until 1991, when the ERMES, European Radio Messaging System, is established for pan-European paging. The four-country consortium, called Europage, is currently negotiating with Austria and Spain, which may also join the consortium.
And now a letter that we received addressed to Radio Fax from Lord Thompson, the chairman of the Independent Broadcasting Authority. Unfortunately, we cannot help you because under the present legislation, the Broadcasting Act 1981, as far as radio is concerned, the IBA can only transmit local sound broadcasting services. In your plan, you cover the British Isles. You probably know that the government intends to introduce legislation, probably late 89 or early 90, which is intended to expand the opportunities for broadcasting. It would probably be prudent for you to press the Home Office to address the HF aspect. It has not featured in any discussions we have had with their officials. HF was also not mentioned in the Green Paper on radio. I am sorry we cannot help, but wish you luck with your exciting project.
Radio Fax will finish in December. We have been on the air for 3 months, and through that time you have been sending us over 100 letters each week telling us how much this kind of speech programming is appreciated. We also know that we have a fair number of very enthusiastic blind listeners. So we remain a legal operation and close down in December, unless some government writes us out the licence we have been asking for since 3 years ago. What would the other possible options be? We could stay on the air from the Republic of Ireland, or we could come on the air from England. By making public the time and place, this would be a fairly straightforward act of civil disobedience, and the presumably inevitable court case would form part of the history of broadcasting. If hundreds of you write to say that is what you think we should do, then I suppose we would have to consider it seriously. But we have to make it clear now that these are not options we regard as compatible with a professional operation.
The letters you send are what has made this project worthwhile, and thank you again to everybody who has taken the trouble to write. We get letters from people aged between 17 and 70, and anyone in the media world will know that something appealing to such an age range is most unusual. Some of the historical items we have carried are the development of magnetic tape, the story of radar, old BBC transmitting stations, the inventions of magnetic recording, from wire recorders to digital tape, and others have brought in letters from people involved in the work up to 50 years ago. If we were staying on the air, one thing we would have liked to do was organise a contact point so that people who worked together years ago could get in touch with each other again.
One thing we have achieved might be the most listened to programme per watt transmitted. And we mean listened to. Many shortwave stations are heard and logged, but your letters make it clear that people do listen to Radio Fax.
The use of shortwaves has fallen significantly over the last 20 years, and everyone seems agreed that, with a view to the future, what Radio Fax has demonstrated is now a useful and appropriate use of 9 kHz of the spectrum. What can you do? Well, if you think Radio Fax or something like it should be offered a licence, you could write to your Member of Parliament at the House of Commons, London SW1A OAA. And the ministers responsible are Douglas Hurd and Timothy Renton at the Home Office, Queen Anne's Gate, London SW1H 9AT.